Save big at Menards and prepare for the summer heat with a new air conditioner from Denali Air. Quickly and efficiently cool your spaces with auto and eco modes to maximize performance and save on energy costs. Cool your space from anywhere in the room with three cooling speeds and a remote control. Save big money on Denali Air air conditioners. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money
at Menards. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to five pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Anything to lose. I have no secrets to hide. I could just be blunt and people could judge it however they judge it.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. What exactly happened to Demario Lowe's? That's the question that we're going to be trying to answer today. In this episode, we're taking a step back from witness statements, shifting times, and missing work records, and instead we're going to focus on the concrete facts of the initial investigation. The crime scene investigation, the autopsy, and the forensics. We'll begin with the crime scene. For you longtime listeners, you know that typically the crime scene would be an episode all on its own. In many cases, it takes multiple episodes to fully evaluate. But in this instance, we can get it done in just half an episode, primarily because we have no crime scene photos to pick apart and very little documentation to work with. The documents that we do have come from multiple sources. Since the Berrien County Homicide Task Force was engaged in the investigation, we have reports from the initial arriving officers, Detective McGinnis, Detective McKinney, and the Benton Harbor PD crime scene techs, as well as the state police. As you can imagine, with all that going on, it's been no easy task organizing the information into a flowing narrative, so we decided that the best path forward is to break down each of the reports, and lastly, we'll cover the trial testimony of Benton Harbor crime scene tech, Kevin McGee. Let's begin with the first arriving officer, Chris Takamoto. When Takamoto arrived on the scene, he observed a small two-door red hatchback in what he calls the driveway of the apartment house. The engine was running and the hatchback was open. For a little better understanding of what the crime scene looked like, I'm uploading to our website two more crime scene diagrams. In the murder book, we only have the one that I posted a few weeks ago, the one with the number notations on the side. But in the prosecutor's copy of the file, there are actually two more diagrams, all three created by the same person, Michigan State Trooper Matt Waters. And on that note, I actually know Matt. I spent 3 years working in the same office as him. He's retired now, but I reached out to him today and asked him if he could take a look at the drawings to help me figure out what the numbers on the sketch mean. He agreed to take a look, but after examining them, he does remember the incident, but does not remember what those notations were for. At this point, he's still looking into it to see if maybe he can figure it out. Now, to give you an idea of what the scene looked like, 784 Broadway was a two-story house. It was narrow and long, and divided into two apartments. One upstairs where the Miles family lived, and one downstairs where Sonia Lucas and her family lived. The stairs to get to the second floor apartment were inside the building. I believe they were the actual original steps from back in the day when this was a single family home. You would open the front door and step into a foyer type area that the police reports refer to as a hallway. To the right was the staircase, and the stairs had a 90 degree turn. So you would take about three steps up, turn to your left, and then continue up to the second floor. Underneath the stairs was a storage room. Directly in front of the front door, once you step into the foyer, was Sonia Lucas's door. The foyer area appears to be about 6 feet wide and maybe 8 feet deep. That's the distance between the front door and Sonia's door, about 8 feet. Mario was found in the foyer, and while it's not noted in Takamoto's report, multiple witnesses from across the street said that his arm was hanging out of the front door and visible from outside. And here's where things get really confusing or really interesting, depending on your perspective. Takamoto's report says that the door was, quote, about 3/4 open, but he doesn't say why. And furthermore, his description of the position of Mario's body is inconsistent with the witness statements, but his version does make it possible for Sonia to have spoken to Mario from her doorway. Takamoto says that Mario's head was pointed southwest and his feet were pointed northeast. This will make more sense if you take a look at the sketch, but I'll try to paint a picture here for you. Basically, Takamoto was saying that Mario's feet were near the front door by the stairs headed to the Miles apartment, and his head was pointed towards the back left of the foyer by Sonia's door. But the witnesses all say that his arm was hanging out the front door, which would mean that his head was as far away from Sonia's door as possible, and the front door itself, that was noted to be 3/4 of the way open, would be between Sonia and Mario's head. Here, Takamoto describes the condition of DeMario when he arrived. From his report, quote, "The victim's pants were below his waist around his thigh area. His white underwear was exposed. The victim was lying on his back and was rasp breathing with a faint pulse. And I was trying to find wounds on the victim to determine what type of first aid treatment to render. The victim stopped breathing and had no pulse. Medic 1 arrived on scene, in parentheses Dan Daniels, and pronounced the victim dead. I saw that the victim had several gunshot wounds. I saw that the victim has one gunshot wound under his right armpit area, one gunshot wound to his left torso area, two gunshot wounds to his left hip area, one to his left shoulder area, and about three to his right elbow area. Lying on the hallway floor near the victim's right hip area was a silver dollar charm. There was blood around the wounds. I saw that the victim was wearing a white hooded sweatshirt, white t-shirt under the sweatshirt, a white headband, white Fruit of the Loom brief underwear, blue jean long pants, and brown boots. There was blood on the area of the victim's clothing where the bullet wound were on him. I also saw that there was one silver bullet casing on the hallway floor about 1 foot west of the front doorway. There was also two silver spent casings on the third step of the stair leading from the hallway to the upstairs apartment. There was a spent bullet, gold, on the sixth step of the stairs. The spent bullet and casing appeared to be .45 caliber. There was one bullet hole on the bottom north window frame next to the stairs. There was also one bullet hole in the eighth and tenth step of the stairs. The holes appeared to be from a large caliber firearm. I then secured the scene upon the detective's request. The next officer to document the crime scene was Detective McKinney. But between Takamoto observing Mario's body and McKinney doing the same, paramedic Dan Daniels had arrived on the scene. His testimony is posted on our website. It's very short and not enlightening at all. I looked at his testimony because McKinney describes the body in a different position from Takamoto, and I wanted to know if the medics had moved it. Unfortunately, I still don't know. The EMS report, of course, is missing from the file, the report that would have the actual time of the run on it, and Daniel's trial testimony is all of 3.5 pages long. Did you go to the scene? Was the victim dead when you got there? Did you try to resuscitate him? The answer to that was no. And did you later transport the body to the ME? That was it. We learned that EMS did not attempt to revive Mario, but no one asks if he moved the body or worked on him at all. I did, however, notice more of the sleight of hand by the prosecutor regarding the time of the murder. Listen to this exchange from the beginning of the testimony. Cotter, back on November 16, 2001, a little after 12:40 a.m., were you on duty? Yes, I was. Did there come a time when you were dispatched to 784 Broadway in Benton Harbor in reference to a shooting victim? Yes. End quote. When you hear that, it sounds like Daniels is acknowledging that he was dispatched to the shooting at 12:40. But Cotter was very careful not to connect those dots. Were you on duty at 12:40? Yes. Then, did there come a time when you went to 784 Broadway? Yes. He never asked the obvious question, what time were you dispatched to 784 Broadway? McKinney begins his crime scene description with either a massive lie or a massive screw-up. And there's definitely one glaring mistake. There is just so much wrong with this one sentence. From his report, quote, 784 Pavone Street is a two-story dwelling with only the upstairs being occupied, end quote. First of all, it's Broadway, not Pavone. And secondly, he says that only the upstairs apartment was occupied. This in and of itself should be a problem for the Sonia speaking to Mario story. According to McKinney, no one even lived in the downstairs apartment. Now, we know that's not true, so I'm kind of left baffled by the statement. We know that the downstairs apartment was in fact occupied by Sonia Lucas, and we also know that she was interviewed and her apartment was searched that night. I believe by McKinney. So we'll move on from that, but I couldn't just read past it without pointing out the deception slash incompetence that's going on there. McKinney goes on to describe DeMario's car as being parked in the adjacent vacant lot to the north of the building, which is where the witnesses described it as well. There really was no driveway to the building itself, like Takamoto described. There was a driveway into the vacant lot. He goes on to describe the position of Mario's body as being in the hallway next to the stairs with his head facing south and his feet facing north. McKinney described the same clothing as Takamoto and says that he observed two gunshot wounds with blood penetrating the hoodie. And he also notes some shell casings and a bullet. Quote, next to the deceased victim, I observed two spent shell casings that appeared to be from a .45 caliber semi-automatic. Located in the stairwell, I observed two more spent shell casings and one spent bullet lodged in the base of one stair, end quote. From here, McKinney's report moves on to interviewing Victoria Miles. At least in this version, the one in the police department version of the murder book. But what I found really interesting is that when reading through the prosecutor's version of the murder book this week, I found this very same report, but it looked very different. In the version of McKinney's report that was turned over to the prosecutor, the entire section about interviewing Victoria Miles, the one that said she was interviewed at 12:30 and where she said the murder happened at 11:45, was edited out like it never happened.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Detective McGinnis was next to arrive at 784 Broadway and document the scene. His initial observations were brief. When McGinnis arrives, the scene had already been taped off and secured. He notes that DeMario's car was parked to the north of the building in an empty lot, and like Takamoto, he notes that it was running and the trunk was open. Sergeant London then informed McGinnis that there were, quote, some spent shell casings outside the vehicle between it and the building, end quote. McGinnis then notes that by the time he arrived on scene, a white sheet had been hung up over the door to block the view of the body from bystanders. His description of Mario's clothing and wounds is essentially the same as the other officers. However, McGinnis makes no notes about the position of the body, other than the fact that Mario was lying on his back. At approximately 1 a.m., McGinnis says that he initiated the Berrien County Homicide Task Force. The crime scene was processed by Benton Harbor officers McGee and Greer, and Michigan State Troopers Vargas and Waters also processed the scene in the morning during the daylight hours. When MSP Troopers Vargas and Waters got to the scene, the body had already been removed, and they were only given a vague idea of where Mario had been positioned. But note the time they were given. From the report, quote, The body had since been removed since this happened approximately 12 midnight on the previous evening. End quote. Must be another typo. In any case, the troopers noted and measured the bullet holes and collected two bullets from the scene. The report indicates that all three bullet holes appear to have been made by the same caliber round, later determined to be a .45. That's the hole in the windowsill in the stairwell, the bullet hole in the fascia of the ninth stair, and the hole in the lip of the 10th stair. The actual slug was recovered and collected from the windowsill. It was lodged in the wood behind the trim board. Interestingly, the bullet hole in the 9th stair had a path that indicated it was fired at a downward angle, which would mean that the shooter was following Mario up the stairs. That round passed through the fascia of the steps, then through the exterior wall, and was not recovered. The bullet hole in the lip of the 10th step was fired straight on, not above or below, and was recovered from the storage room below the stairwell. So now we're starting to get a picture of how the murder happened. We have shell casings outside between Mario's car and the building, shell casings inside the foyer area, and shell casings on the stairs. We also have a bullet hole in the window by the stairs and bullet holes in two of the top steps. Piecing that together, the shooter began firing at Mario outside by the car. He then fled into the building to get away. His killer followed closely behind and continued to shoot at Mario. The casings in the foyer and the bullet hole in the window suggest Mario was trying to run up the stairs, and the offender shot at him from just inside the door. Then, as Mario started running up the stairs, his attacker was chasing him up while continuing to fire at him. We know this because of the bullet holes in the upper steps in their trajectory. I think that we can assume that this was where the fatal shots were made. Mario never made it to the top of the steps and eventually died back down on the floor of the foyer. Officer McKee testified at trial about his full crime scene investigation, and the entirety of that testimony, including cross-examination, was just 27 pages. Just like with all the other witnesses, Prosecutor Cotter didn't make any attempt to pin down a time with McGee. He just asked if he responded to the call on Broadway in the early morning hours of November 16th. McGee testified that when he arrived on scene, the body was still there. And this is one of the fastest-moving direct examinations that I've ever read. You can read it for yourself on the website. Right away. Did you go to the scene? Was the body there? Did you collect the shell casings? 2 pages in, and we've already made it from the hey, how you doings to the evidence collection. The next few pages contain McGee's testimony as he explains where he collected all the shell casings. Several photos are entered into evidence, but unfortunately, we're now told that these photos no longer exist. It's really frustrating that we don't have any of these photos because McGee is not particularly great at articulating where exactly the casings were found, and he sometimes mixes up spent rounds, which would be an actual projectile, and spent casings, the shell that's ejected from the gun as it's fired. So it becomes confusing as you read through the testimony. One thing to note is that, if I'm reading this correctly, that there appears to be shell casings north of Mario's car. And Mario's car was located north of the building. So remember back to McGinnis's report of seeing shell casings between the building and the car, and now we're learning that there are also casings on the other side of the car. That would lead me to conclude that the shooting started at the car. They're all a little bit different, but generally speaking, most semi-automatic pistols eject their shell casings to the right at a backward angle, and they don't eject particularly far. So imagine if you're holding a pistol out in front of you and you pull the trigger. You'll likely find the ejected casing to your right and probably a couple feet behind your shooting position. The casings don't eject super far away, so for them to end up on the north side of the car, I think we can conclude that the shooter was either standing on the north side or standing at the rear of the vehicle when they fired the shots, between the vehicle and Broadway Street. If they were in front of, meaning to the west of the car, firing toward the building, the casings would not end up on the north side of the vehicle. All that to say that the shooter began shooting while standing very close to Mario's car, most likely at the trunk. I'm going to try to make a video animation of where the shots were fired this week, or at least I'm going to do my best based on the limited information that we have. I know my explanation here is probably confusing to some of you, and I can assure you that reading the trial transcript where they're talking about what they see in photos that we don't have isn't much help either. But big picture, According to Victoria Miles, Mario's killer approached from the alley. He and Mario talked calmly for a bit near his car. That then escalated into an argument. The killer began shooting at Mario while they were still out by the car. Mario ran to the front door with the shooter chasing behind him, still shooting. Mario entered the front door and immediately turned to the right to head up the stairs to Victoria's apartment. The shooter was right behind him. He fired a shot from inside the front door at Mario on the stairs and hit the windowsill. I think Mario must have already been hit at this point because he didn't make it more than a couple steps up the staircase before at least two more shots were fired. And the shooter was on the staircase with Mario at that point. The killer then flees, and Mario either falls down the stairs or he walked down and collapsed on the floor in front of the front door. Here's something that I find to be really intriguing. A small baggie of marijuana was found on the scene, but it was not found on Mario or near his body. It was found on the sidewalk in front of the house. I find it intriguing because this is something that could actually belong to the shooter. Both Mario and the killer ran into the house, and the killer obviously ran back out. Presumably, Mario was running for his life, but the attacker was fumbling with a gun, especially on the way out. I would think that they would have been tucking it into a pocket or a waistband as they fled. That seems like a more likely scenario for what's described as a 1-inch by 1-inch baggie of marijuana to fall out of someone's pocket, more so than just running. The point being that if the baggie is still in evidence, I think it would at least be worth testing it for DNA. It was presented by the state that Mario was not robbed, and that that motive should be ruled out. This was based on the items that were recovered from his body. A silver-colored necklace with a pendant with a picture of Jesus on it, a couple of rings, and $81 in cash. That's all he had on him. The state's theory being that if Mario was being robbed, the killer would have pulled the $81 from his pocket and taken the jewelry with him after the murder. Now, there's still too many unknowns to properly develop a profile, but here's my take based on what we know so far. The state contends that this was a hit, that Jody killed Mario to stop him from testifying against Leon in the armed robbery case. Well, first of all, this does not look like a hit to me. Richard Perry's murder from episode 1 was a hit. The killer snuck up behind him and shot him in the back of the head. In this case, Mario went to 784 Broadway because he had something to do, according to Canvas Smith. I believe he was meeting someone there. He waits in the vacant lot next to the building for 45 minutes, according to Victoria, and eventually someone shows up. The discussion starts out calm, but then it escalates. Then the shooting starts. And like I said earlier, it seems like Mario was already mortally wounded before he ran up the stairs. He didn't even make it to the top. And gunshot wounds don't affect people in real life like they do on TV. People don't just fall over and die when they get shot in the chest. It takes a minute or two for the lungs to fill with blood. Point being, it's very possible that the killer connected with the shots out by the car, and yet they continued to chase Mario into the house and kept shooting until, I believe, they thought he was dead. Which is one of the main reasons why I didn't believe Sonia's testimony. Why would the killer chase Mario all the way into the house and up the stairs continuing to shoot at him and then leave while he was still able to speak? From a profiling standpoint, and again, we're too early for an actual full profile, but I'm asking myself, why would someone continue to pursue Mario after they had shot him? To me, the answer seems obvious. Mario knew his attacker. He could identify him. And the killer had to make sure that he was dead. And that would explain why the attack ended the way it ended, but more importantly, we need to figure out why it began in the first place. What was the motive? What starts out as a calm conversation, escalates into an argument, and then ends in murder? Could be a lot of things, and I'm not ready to even speculate about what some of those reasons might be, but this is what's concerning to me. There are a couple of elements of this case, besides the apparent framing of Jody Hill, that strike me as really, really odd. As I mentioned on the follow-up on Friday, Mario had a cell phone. There's a document in the state's file that logged when his cell phone was returned to Rolanda, his girlfriend. but there's no record here of the phone actually being collected from the crime scene, and there's no record of it ever being analyzed. So there's a break in the loop. Mario has his phone, then the police give his phone back to Rolanda, but when did they get his phone, and what did they do with it? Whatever the thing was that Mario had to do that night, the reason that he dropped Candace off and told her he'd pick her up later, you would think would have been on that phone. Who did he call or who called him? The phone mysteriously showing up when it's returned to Rolanda is a big problem for me. And the other thing that just does not sit right with me is the gun. Mario was shot with a .45 caliber semi-automatic pistol. If you don't know anything about guns or about the weapons used in most inner-city shootings, then that probably doesn't mean much to you. But if you do any research at all into the types of guns used in these types of crimes and where they come from, you won't find a .45 caliber semi-automatic pistol on most charts at all. And when you do, they usually make up less than 2%. Which makes sense for a few reasons. To begin with, there are far fewer of them on the streets than other models. In one Bureau of Justice report, over a 20-year period, there were a total of 1.7 million .45s manufactured nationwide. That's compared to over 6 million of the more popular models. And secondly, .45s are expensive. Very expensive. And so are the bullets that go into them. It happens, but it's very rare for .45s to find their way into the hands of people living in impoverished communities. The most common handguns seized in communities like Benton Harbor are 9mm and .22 caliber revolvers. Nines are far less expensive than .45s, and the ammo is much, much cheaper. They're also produced at over twice the rate as the .45s. But the weapon that rises above all others is the .22 caliber pistol. They're cheap. You can buy one legitimately from a gun shop for $100 to $200, and I've even seen them for under $100. And the ammo is also really cheap, like really cheap. You can buy it in boxes of 500 rounds for about what that arugula salad cost me. And they're also preferred for the commission of crimes because revolvers don't eject the empty shell casings. They leave no evidence behind. And they're also quiet compared to other pistols. That's a long explanation, but let me circle back to where I started. The killer using a .45 caliber semi-auto pistol is odd. Like, really odd. And I think that's something that needs to be pinned away in our minds for when we eventually profile the scene. The killer was using a very expensive gun, firing very expensive bullets, and while it is not unheard of, it's definitely a statistical anomaly. Case in point. When Mario was held up 3 days earlier, the would-be robbers were wielding a .22 caliber pistol and a cheap shotgun. The last element of the crime scene that we're going to discuss today is the victim's body. An autopsy was performed on DeMario the morning of November 16th by Dr. Paul Tam. Dr. Tam's trial testimony was short and sweet, totaling just 11 pages, the first four of which were dedicated to establishing him as a qualified expert. We learned through his testimony that Detective McGinnis was present during the autopsy, along with the crime scene tech that we just heard about, Kevin McGee. Based on witness statements and an average of the counts of shell casings found at the scene, it appears that there were around 8 shots fired at DeMario that night. And according to Dr. Tam, 4 of those rounds connected. On the stand, the doctor described each of the 4 bullet wounds, but keep in mind these are in no particular order. It's just not possible to know the order in which the shots were fired. The first wound described was a shot to Mario's left hip. That shot entered in the front and exited out the back. So we can reasonably conclude that this shot didn't come when Mario was running away. Dr. Tam says that the wound was not fatal and did not hit any major organs. He doesn't testify about it hitting any bone, but the actual autopsy report indicates that it did not. It was through and through, essentially a flesh wound. The next wound was to Mario's right shoulder. This one entered in the back and exited out the front. Again, non-fatal and no bony structures were hit. Another through-and-through flesh wound. The trajectory of this was at an upward angle from back to front, which might lead you to believe that this shot must have happened in the stairwell, but keep in mind that all it would take to create the same angle would be for Mario to hunch over a little bit as he was running. There are too many unknowns to know the actual position of the shooter. Remember, crime scenes like this are dynamic. Both parties are moving and bending as things unfold. The next wound is another shot from behind. This one also wasn't fatal, but definitely painful. The shot entered and exited Mario's left upper arm, again from behind, but this one shattered his humerus bone. Basically, it entered through the tricep and exited out the bicep, breaking the upper arm bone in the process. Then the last wound discussed was the fatal shot. That shot entered again from behind in Mario's right lower torso, so the bottom part of his rib cage, and exited out in front of his left shoulder. This bullet pierced both lungs and severed major arteries along the way. Dr. Tam testified that Mario would have bled to death internally from this wound. In fact, he said that he recovered a liter of blood from each lung. Direct examination ended with the results of the blood alcohol test performed on Mario. His blood showed a level of 0.16, and his urine came back at 0.13. Basically, Mario was intoxicated at the time of his murder. 0.16 is double the legal limit to drive in Michigan. The defense attorney, White, then misses the mark again on cross-examination. He asked Dr. Tam how long he believes that it would have taken Mario to bleed to death. And Tam says that he would have been dead in 3 to 5 minutes after taking the shot to the chest. And that was it. That was all the cross-examination. He failed to ask the most important question. The one that flagged Sonia's testimony as false to me. Could Mario have spoken after the bullet ripped through his lungs and began filling them with blood? The question, unfortunately, was never asked. And I'm no expert, and my experience is limited to textbooks and my anecdotal experiences working on patients as a firefighter. I personally do not believe Mario would have been able to speak. With one punctured lung, sure. But two, no. No way in hell. And as I mentioned before, I don't believe that the killer would have left the scene after chasing Mario all the way up the stairs if he was still talking at all. The last thing that I want to touch on today was the testing performed on the evidence from the crime scene. And there really isn't much of it to speak of. Fingerprint lifts were taken off of Mario's car, but they weren't of any use. None of them were even comparable. The only real usable forensic evidence from the crime scene was DNA taken from the bullet casings. 6 casings were sent to a lab, and Michigan State Police analyst Joel Schultz testified at trial about the results. There was a mixture of 3 different DNA profiles on the 6 shell casings that were tested. Unfortunately, we don't know exactly how that mixture comes together because Schultz swabbed all 6 casings with 1 swab and then tested all of that together. But those 3 profiles that were obtained were compared to Jody, and Jody was excluded as a possible contributor. The profiles were then entered into CODIS with no matches. Now, on its face, the DNA evidence seems like it should have exonerated Jody. The murder weapon was a semi-automatic pistol. To load a gun like this, you have to press the bullets into a spring-loaded magazine or clip that is then inserted into the handle of the gun. It's a tedious process, and it requires a lot of friction and force from your fingers. Your thumb, actually. Point being that loading the rounds into the magazine will cause a lot of shedding of skin cells. Practically speaking, the most likely explanation for DNA on the shell casings is that the contributor was the person who loaded the gun. But at trial, this evidence was brushed aside. The prosecutor suggested that the DNA could have simply come from the manufacturer of the bullets. And while Schultz explained that for that to be true, the skin cells would have to hang onto the cartridge for a long time, survive being packaged, jostled around, loaded into the gun, and also hold up through the heat of the round being fired. Basically, it's not likely it came from the manufacturer, but he also didn't rule it out as a possibility. He couldn't. And since there was no match on the DNA, and therefore no one to point the finger at, the testimony was short and sweet and didn't seem to sway the jury at all. On September 3rd, 2004, 2 years after Jody was convicted, the Michigan State Crime Lab got a hit on the DNA from the shell casings. Someone had been convicted of committing a felony, and their DNA was added to the CODIS database. The same analyst who testified at trial, Joel Schultz, sent an email to Dan McGinnis with the new results. We now know whose DNA was on the shell casings. Convicted felon, Andrew Wayne Bell. Bell had been arrested in Benton Harbor on February 24th of 2002, just 3 months after Mario's murder, between the time when the murder occurred and Jody's trial, which happened in the fall of 2002. Bell was arrested and later convicted for maintaining slash keeping a drug house. But Bell's conviction didn't come until 8 months after Jody's, in July of 2003, and that's when his DNA was entered into CODIS. Bell was later convicted again for a 2010 offense for carrying a concealed pistol, and again in 2012 for dealing narcotics. All right there in Benton Harbor, under McGinnis's nose, the entire time. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music for Season 15 is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kay Wood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.